Well, we welcome back here this morning to our program one of a group of guests that are on the show every month. And the guest is Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign and has a private practice here in our area. And each month, always on a Monday, she is here on the program. We talk about women's health. She usually comes prepared to talk about some things that are new, may have been in the news, and there certainly are some. But also the idea of the program is if you have questions about your own health or someone who is close to you, call in and discuss it with the doctor. There are obviously some limitations because we're here working over the phone. We can't diagnose over the phone. We always like to try to remind people of that. But we do these programs to try to help you and to add to your store of health knowledge. And it would be a place to start. And then, of course, if you have other questions, you should pursue them with your own doctor. Having said all that, let me give you the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. But if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being
here. Thank you, and good morning.
A lot of stuff actually new.
Exciting month for women's health.
Well, where would you like to start?
Well, we had the release of the first new contraceptive agent in 5 years, Lunel. It's a contraceptive injection. We were part of what's called the phase 3 clinical study, which is the final phase of research that a product must go through before being approved by the FDA. And it was approved last Friday. By the FDA, and we're anticipating Lunel hit the pharmacies in December. And it's going to be a once-a-month injection. It is going to be different from Depo-Provera in that Depo-Provera is a three-month injection. It's only progesterone, no estrogen, and women do not have menstrual periods. In contrast, Lunel, the new product, is an estrogen-progesterone combination. It is designed, if you take the shot every 28 days, you will have a modest period every 28 days. So you will be more likely to have regular periods, and it will offer women yet another contraceptive choice. Mm-hmm. Also, another important feature about Lunel compared to Depo-Provera is its reversibility. About 60% of women are pregnant in 3 months of trying to get pregnant after their last injection. So that is a big benefit because Depo-Provera was so potent, it actually stays in your system significantly longer.
Well, what other than perhaps that advantage that if you decide that you want to get pregnant, it'll move out of your system more quickly. What would be some of their, as a woman is thinking about her various choices for contraception, what would be some of the reasons that you might want to choose this?
Well, it's only once a month. So you do have a little bit more immediate reversibility. If you don't like it, you could switch to birth control pills. You can get an IUD, whatever. It's only good for a month. So I think the time course is significantly important. It also does have some estrogen, so it avoids some of the theoretical disadvantages of low estrogen, particularly for young individuals, that Depo-Provera has. And it also allows you some flexibility in when you get it. So even though it's a once-a-month shot, we've got a 10-day window as to when you can come in and get your shot. So you could get your shot in 23 days or you could get your shot in 33 days. It'll produce a little bit more irregular bleeding if you do that. In other words, excuse me, there was a question of whether or not there would be a little bit less weight gain on the Lunel than Depo-Provera also. We think that may be true.
Okay. We have a caller here with a question that we want to talk with. And other folks who are listening, you certainly can call as well. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Caller's in Mansfield on our toll-free line. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I have a question, I think, sort of at the other end of the spectrum. I'm in my 50s, and I'm very concerned about bone density. And I know that... there just seems to be a mass of information out there. And Then you see the screenings that they have at health fairs, you know, that you can line up and get a bone density screening, and I've never done that. So I thought that I could schedule my own, you know, that you can just call up and get a bone density, you know, screening. And I was told that I would have to get that prescribed through my gynecologist. And then my gynecologist said that I wasn't eligible for bone density screening, so I guess I'm kind of asking about the necessity for bone density screenings. And
that is a great question.
Oh,
and actually, some radiology departments are a little bit more flexible, or they will allow for your primary care physician to prescribe. I don't know if you're on a health plan, and you don't have to tell me. I'm just saying that in some health plans, they've used insurance guidelines to sort of be the rationale for who they order tests on and who they don't order tests on. And perhaps your gynecologist felt that they didn't want to approve, therefore your insurance was going to cover. But for self-referral, if you just said to your gynecologist nurse, I would really like to get this test, can you just give me a referral so I can just go ahead and get it. Usually that's a pretty flexible approach, and many offices will comply. But just to stand back a little bit, there is a ton of confusion about who should or should not have bone density testing, and if you should have it, when should you have it? Let's start with the areas of who makes recommendations. Well, the World Health Organization makes a recommendation. The American College of Radiology makes a recommendation. American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists make recommendations. And needless to say, they aren't all the same. And then there's just sort of expert opinion. I think that anybody who has risk factors for osteoporosis should probably have a screening at some point. And again, exactly when to get that it's questionable, but risk factors would be any low estrogen states, smokers, people who have had a bone fracture, people who have parents that have had osteoporosis, particularly at a young age. These are a few of the literally couple of dozen risk factors we use to formulate in. So you get over the age of 65, some physicians haven't been interested in getting their patients' bone densities because such a huge percentage of the patient population has osteoporosis, they don't necessarily see the value. Also, most physicians are taught that if they're going to get a test, they need to be able to act on that test in order for it to be worthwhile. And if they don't understand how to interpret the test, or they don't understand what the different options are for therapy based on the various test reports, they're not going to be real anxious to get that report. In our practice, we think a couple of things. One, I think these peripheral scans are very useful. They can be done on the finger, they can be done on the wrist, they can be done on the heel, and those are the ones that you will see in health fairs, and they are in some physician offices. They're a great screen. They're inexpensive. They're quick. They're painless. And if the readout is very high or very low, in other words, very normal or very much osteoporotic, they're extremely accurate. Then from those, we use that test and combine with a few other factors to decide who to get more the so-called full densitometry screening, which isn't full either. It's the lower spine and the hip, but it's considered more accurate. We usually get anybody over the age of 40 a peripheral screen, and when to repeat is an issue. Some doctors say every 2 years, some doctors say every 5 years. And then I like most of my patients by the age of 65 to have a full DEXA unless we've ordered one before that. And then you use that information in planning medication, because the medication's long term, it's expensive, there are different options. And if you really don't need to start it even yet in your early 50s, perhaps it's something that you want to hold off on. And with proper use of bone density testing, some people can hold off on their medication for years. It's a big topic. I hope that was
okay. This is a big help.
A good enough summary, but good luck. Try to get a bone density.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We have another caller here, and we'd welcome others. Maybe I should again mention our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program with us every month. It's always a Monday, and we talk about women's health. This is your opportunity to call and ask questions. It can be about anything that she deals with in her practice, so that's a very wide range of possibility. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a local caller next in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. It's mm-hmm. always a pleasure to listen to Dr. Troopin. My question is, how many locations in Champaign-Urbana provide a bone density? Does Christie, does the university, you know, things?
Well, okay, it's a good question. The university does have a machine, but it's only used in research settings. So we do send some of our patients there at the present time, but it's only for specific research studies. The Christie Clinic does have a bone density testing. Carle Clinic has bone density testing. And those are, I think Christie is at the clinic and Carl's at the hospital, but I think so. And I think at Weaver Radiology, they have a bone densitometry. Now, I know I have a peripheral scan, and I can't tell you exactly who else might have one for peripheral testing, but that's all I know about.
Yes, Weaver Radiology, you said, has mm-hmm. a full bone density test.
Yes.
Do you know the costs of these various locations?
I don't exactly. I know ballpark. Usually for peripheral scans, you would expect to pay about $75, $80. And usually for full bone testing, it's more in the $250 to $300 range, something like that.
And where is the Christie machine located?
I'm not sure, but I think at their main facility.
Clinic. Okay. Thank you so much for the information.
All right. Very good. And we'll proceed again to another caller here. This is also Urbana, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Have a quick question about Avista and what's the name of the other bone builder that is not a hormonal replacement?
Fosamax. And yes. There's also Actinel, which is a cousin to Fosamax that was released in the past few months.
Yeah, I'm talking about Fosamax. Well, you can include that other one then in this question. Jury always remaining out, I know, on these things. But at this point, how do you evaluate the difference between them and what they give you, what their benefits are? I have used the Fosamax, and I'm now using Avista. And I, you know, I'm at this point going to reorder, and I want to know, at this point, what's the best for bone building?
Well, really, when we take a couple of steps back and we talk about bone building, you really should include estrogen. The Avista it is a synthetic, it acts like an estrogen on bone, but it's a so-called designer estrogen. So Avista and estrogen have much more potent general body effects. And then you get to strictly the medications that only treat bone. Actinel and Fosamax are both approved for both prevention of osteoporosis and treatment of osteoporosis. There's a cousin that is not approved specifically except for other kinds of bone kinds of things called atindronate that I don't use much of. I think some endocrinologists may. And then there's calcitonin that's only approved for osteoporosis. And it's a different kind of hormone, but again, specifically works on bone. So a lot depends on what you're trying to accomplish. With estrogen, you're treating the whole menopausal range, and it practically affects every organ in your body.
I'm not going to use estrogen, so let's just dispense with that right now and just say I'm interested in
I understand, and I just
kind of a judgment now about the value of Avista as opposed to Fosamax.
I understand, but I'm trying to sort of give the big picture for others who may be listening so that they kind of understand. When you step back and you talk about a bone treatment, and then you can talk about the percent that you expect your bones to gain in density, in thickness, exactly what we were talking about with these measurements. You can also talk about what you can expect to gain in fracture prevention. And it's not just thick bones that aren't fracturing. There's something else that goes on, because we know that some people may not gain in thickness. That's where you have to, where this whole bone density testing becomes so confusing. Not all bones gain in thickness, but some get fracture prevention. Okay, so then this is how I try to decide. Absolutely. Number one, some people aren't going to take estrogen. Number two, Evista is an estrogen. It's synthetic. It's a designer estrogen. It works as anti-estrogen in some forms, but it's going to act like estrogen in many other tissues besides bone, for instance, on the heart system. So that's a good thing. There are probably other ways as Evista acts as an estrogen that we haven't discovered because it's so new. Fosamax, Actonel, Calcitonin only act on the bones. And that is where if you need medication that's going to act in other organ systems, for instance, Evista may help to prevent breast cancer, then the pendulum's going to swing towards Evista. But if you talk about which is best for bones, then there are two measurements. One, the thickness, and they all actually overlap in percent gain thickness. In a menopausal woman, on the average, she can gain about 2% a year on these medications. Maybe some studies, Fosamax, have a little bit more, maybe some studies of Evista a little bit less. However, it's about 2%, although we tend to have about 10 to 15% complete non-responders. Fosamax as a medicine is the only one out there that has been shown to prevent hip fracture. It's why it gets a big gold star on my piece of paper when I'm weighing risks and benefits, because Fosamax shows to prevent hip fracture. And women who get hip fractures are the women who suffer the most the consequences of osteoporosis.
Okay.
Also, with Fosamax, there's one other thing that most doctors don't know, but hopefully we're going to be getting this message out soon, is that you can take it just once a week. And that is a big benefit. But most doctors don't prescribe that way. You can do that with Actonel, too. They're coming out with a 70-milligram tablet for Fosamax, so that if you're on the 10-milligram dose, you just take 70. But they already have a 40-milligram tablet, so if you're on the 5 milligrams a day, you can take 140. If you're on the 10 milligrams a day, you can take 2, and you just have to take them once a week. But many physicians aren't aware of that dosing.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Why should that – were we only talking there about a difference in convenience? That is,
well,
you don't have to remember to take it every day, or does it make
– It makes a big difference medically, because Fosamax and Actonel are a little bit tough to take. Their absorption is sort of poor. You've got to take it on an empty stomach. You've got to take it with a big glass of water. It's a little bit caustic to the lining of the esophagus and the stomach. And it turns out that the esophageal, cells, particularly in the esophagus, that are delicate and sensitive to the Fosamax will regenerate in 5 days. So if you only take it once every 7 days, you're so much less likely to get that stomach upset. And same with Actonel. Now, the one benefit I didn't get a chance to mention with Actonel that I like a lot is that with Actonel, it's approved for use 2 hours after a meal. Fosamax, only approved for first thing in the morning. Actonel, you could eat lunch, then not eat anything for a couple hours and actually take it on an empty stomach. So that's a big benefit, too.
Okay. And again, to another caller. This is, again, Urbana, line number one.
Yes, I have a sister who takes Fosamax and does have osteoporosis. And now my brother has been diagnosed as having osteoporosis. And it seems to me in the news, I did hear that Fosamax can be used by men.
Correct. And he should maybe talk to his primary care provider.
Okay. Do most doctors know that Fosamax has been approved for men?
Maybe not. but I think Merck, the manufacturers of Fosamax, one of the biggest, you know, pharmaceutical companies in the world, is trying to get the information out. But absolutely.
You mentioned another drug that was used similar to Fosamax.
Actonel.
Has that been approved for men?
I know it would work for men. Off the top of my head, I don't remember, because I truly do not follow the literature for men as well. So you would have to just check with – call a pharmacy.
Okay.
They would know.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. We certainly – because of the kind of coverage the issue of osteoporosis in women gets, we tend to think of that as being a women's problem. What percentage of men have osteoporosis?
Well, you get over to a certain age, and everybody has osteoporosis. Yeah. And but with men, it's much, much later in life, primarily because their testosterone production continues so steadily till they're fairly old. I think the majority of men in their late 70s and 80s probably do have osteoporosis. And I think it's probably an untapped area, really looking into those older men. But I really don't know, because I don't treat the older men, so I can't. I think it would be a great question to ask our primary care, Dr. Swearingen.
Yeah, I'll have to make a note and ask Jeff the next time I see.
Maybe shoot him an email and warn him.
Okay.
He can get spiffed up on the new indications for the new medications.
Okay. On again to Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Trubin. Responding to the approval of the abortion drug, RU486.
Yes.
The Cyril drug company issued a warning about their drug, a drug that G.D. Cyril makes, and this drug is called Cytotec, and I think it's a prostaglandin.
Yes, it is.
Well, would you explain what a prostaglandin is, and would you explain why G.D. Cyril, what G.D. Cyril said is their drug, Cytotec, prostaglandin, should not be used, they say, off-label. They say, please don't use this drug off-label. And would you explain what a prostaglandin is, what it has to do with RU486, and why G.D. Cyril would not want their drug used off-label?
Okay. It's such a complicated topic. Basically, RU486 is an antiprogesterone. It does not work to actually cause an abortion in and of itself. It works in many different ways that and on many different conditions where an antiprogesterone would work. But first, what it causes is sort of a death of the lining tissue of the uterus so that the actual pregnancy begins to pull away from the lining of the uterus. And then if an abortion is going to be induced medically, you have to follow up that RU486 treatment with another treatment that would cause the uterus to contract and to then expel the pregnancy. And there are many prostaglandin analogs meaning a type of prostaglandin available, but the misoprostol under the brand name Cytotec is the one that is the cheapest, the widely available, the safest, the most extensively studied, and the medication that we already use for medical abortions, which are being done completely off-label with a methotrexate misoprostol combination that's been widely available from abortion providers for many years now. The problem is that the pregnancy then expels over time. So it expels about 50% of patients after they take that second drug will expel their pregnancy in 4 hours. But it for the complete 96% effective that we've been hearing in the media, you may have to wait 4 to 6 weeks. This is a long process. Some of the pregnancies will still be continuing. It's a very complicated process. And for that reason, what Cyril is somewhat responding to is they want to be sure that the most responsible use for medication is going to go on out there. And they've also felt like the FDA has somewhat left them in limbo in that even though their product is not approved for abortions by the FDA, releasing specific information with RU486 that talks about the use of misoprostol as follow-up, they feel since it's the package insert of RU486, maybe that will be misconstrued that it's their package insert. And if something goes wrong with that process, that they don't want to be caught in a position where they didn't properly warn consumers that they haven't been part of that process. I think that's my best explanation. So I think that's why they're issuing this warning. But in fact, many, many medicines are used off-label. Actually, the use of estrogen. Every time we talk about the use of estrogen for instance, other than the treatment of hot flashes and the treatment of osteoporosis, pretty much everything else and the treatment of vaginal atrophy, when we talk about estrogen use for the heart, that's off-label. That has nothing to do with the package insert. When we talk about Depo-Provera approved for contraception, if we talk about using it for control of menstrual periods, off-label. So off-labeling as a concept is very complex issue.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Is it the case that, just I'm curious when we continue to talk about off-label uses for medicines, that any physician can prescribe any drug for any reason that he or she sees fit?
Absolutely. What that means is that you can write, I as a physician can write you an order for a medicine. You can go into a pharmacy, they will give you that pill, and you can swallow it. Now, it's strictly up to physician judgment and care as to whether or not the use was appropriate. And this whole label, off-label situation has arisen for many, many reasons. First of all, not all uses of medication are readily apparent to begin with. For instance, the discovery of RU486, they didn't even understand. They were looking for something that was more similar to glucocorticoid or they were looking for a different purpose when they discovered it was a potent antiprogesterone. So you sometimes, and other medicines, for instance, Zyban for anti-smoking. It's a well-known antidepressant, but one psychiatrist noticed, hey, you're not smoking as much when I give you this antidepressant. Poof, it works for smoking cessation. Now, this became known, became in the literature before it's necessarily something that's FDA approved. Now, this FDA approval process is time-consuming, paperwork-consuming. It would, even if I wanted to, the day I discovered that Zyban worked for smoking cessation, if I wanted to tell every other physician, if I wanted to say to the FDA, hey, this works, get it on the label, make it approved, the FDA would say, do a study. Well, by the time you design the study and go to your institutional review boards and get the data and compile the data and submit the data, this can be years. It can be years worth of process. And some companies physically, either they don't want to do the study, maybe Searle doesn't want to do the abortion study, for instance, or maybe they don't want to spend the money, because if by the time you put in millions of dollars to that development and that drug's already out there and maybe the literature's already in good scientific journals so that physicians and patients can go to that scientific journal, get the information they need. They don't necessarily need the backup on the label. Very complicated. Process. This is why, for instance, only ortho-tricycline, but birth control pills have what's called class labeling. In other words, by law, if you're a birth control pill, for the most part, your package insert has to look exactly like every other package insert. They have to talk about the same pregnancy rates. They have to talk about the same side effects. They have to talk about the same indications, the same contraindications, by law. But also, the FDA has allowed a particular company, Ortho Tricycline, to submit their data and say, hey, look at our actual research on acne prevention. And sure enough, they then got the package indication in addition to the class labeling. They're the only pill that can put on there helpful against acne. But why does it work against acne? It raises sex hormone binding globulin, so the male hormones aren't as high a level circulating. And it probably has some direct effect as well, and because it's a birth control pill, it suppresses the amount of testosterone made by the ovary. Every birth control pill out there does the same. Are some better? Actually, some may even be better than ortho-tricycline. Are some worse? Sure, some are worse. But it's the only one that has FDA approval for that. But for most gynecologists, if you walk in and say, hey, I've got some acne, but I'm on this pill, other brand X, I'm on Merced, I'm on Desogen, I'm on something else, should I be switched to ortho-tricycline? Most gynecologists will say, well, if that's your only reason for switching, these pills do the same. So, this is where this whole off-label thing is very complicated. But in the case of the Searle company and the misoprostol, the anti-ulcer drug, side attack, I think the company is particularly concerned because in all the FDA approval of the mifepristone, the RU46, they talk about the use of it. So it's a gray zone. It's a really exciting breakthrough because most of us thought this kind of thing would be the whole stumbling block and prevent it from coming to market. And it probably is going to have tremendous other uses in endometriosis and fibroids. I know there are indications in men. I just don't know them all. And so it is pretty exciting.
Well, I don't want to go on forever on this. Yeah. But let me ask one more question. I'm just sort of, again, curious on this point. Going back to the example, if we say, now you can write me an order for any drug,
right.
I can go to the drugstore and get it and take it. And
correct.
I would expect that if there's a bad outcome,
right.
I can always go back to you and say, you made a mistake and
right.
you're in big trouble. Can I go to the drug company? They didn't have anything to do with it. If it's not approved for that, if it's not labeled for that, can I sue the drug company for a bad
Probably
outcome?
Probably not. Now, I don't know, if you have illegal issues, ask Amy.
I think it would be
important, but absolutely. I think that may be the roadblock. And because of that, and shouldering a lot of personal responsibility and not having shouldered responsibility with the drug company may in fact stop many physicians from writing for certain off-label things. For instance, in the treatment of preterm labor, probably in this city today, probably in our state today, there are many women getting terbutaline, a medication for the treatment of preterm labor. Not indicated. It's an asthma medicine. Not FDA approved for the treatment of preterm labor. However, there's tons of literature on its effectiveness. And ritodrine, the drug that is approved for the treatment of preterm labor, not only may in some research studies have more side effects, but it's extraordinarily expensive because they did the work of going to the FDA and getting their drug approved for the treatment of preterm labor. But no one uses it. Well, I won't say no one. There must be some doctor out there listening who could call in and say, I use it. And they would probably say, I use it because it's approved and terbutaline isn't approved. And if my patient goes ahead and delivers prematurely, I don't want to be accused of not using the FDA-approved medicine. Hmm. Well, it turns out none of the medicines work very well. So we're all in the same boat with whatever we choose. Same with magnesium sulfate. Not approved for the treatment of preterm labor. Use it all the time. So you're right. It leaves you in a sort of a legal pitfall. But this is something doctors do, particularly gynecologists. I guess I can't comment so much on other fields, but it's something we do all the time.
All right. Well, our guest this morning here on Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troop, and she's an obstetrician, gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She also teaches at the UMI Med School. And once a month, she's here on the program. We talk about women's health. Questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, we probably should get back to the topic.
Sure. What other topics? We have many others.
At the very beginning of the program, we talked about one thing that was new, that is a new contraceptive possibility.
Yes.
What else you want to talk about?
October is Ultrasound Awareness Month, and I think that it's particularly exciting because there are new clinical developments in ultrasound. We, a few years ago, had the development of three-dimensional imaging in ultrasound, and now these machines have become clinically available. I know we have one, and it's a expensive machine. It's difficult to learn how to use that technology because the technician performing the ultrasound also has to generate the three-dimensional image with the use of computer enhancements. And yet we think that it will allow capability of much more accurate measurements. It's also very exciting to be able to see the real features. I was going to bring some pictures, but I ran out the door with that. Next month, okay. I'll bring the pictures to show you. But I view this as one exciting new development, and really it's the first truly new development in ultrasound in about 20 years.
Okay. Well, we have another caller here. Let's talk with them, and this will be in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hi, Dr. Trubin. I have a question about epidurals used in childbirth, and I'm wondering if they've changed a lot in the last 10 years, because a lot of the books I read on childbirth talk about the increased risks that a woman and the baby would have if the person chooses to use an epidural, and I wonder if that's changed much over the years.
Well, I'm not sure what books you're reading. There are some risks with epidurals, and there are always going to be some risks. The catheter has to be inserted, and it does slightly have a risk of some local infection and bleeding with the insertion. It also does cause some discomfort going in, and there is some risk of continuing discomfort. There's also a risk of the epidural medication converting and becoming a spinal medication, and that has to be observed for as well. But these risks are very, very low. I think there have been enhancements over the past 10 years. We've used other compounds so that, for instance, I think it was may have been a little more than 10 years ago, but about during that time period, we started using narcotics as well as local anesthetics to provide additional pain relief. So we got the quote-unquote walking epidural, in other words, an epidural that doesn't completely numb your legs so that you can actually still walk around in labor and still have an epidural, which has been pretty exciting for some women and certainly much more comfortable. And I think that we've learned how to manage labors. For instance, it's still a little bit of an argument between the obstetricians and the anesthesiologist as to whether or not it slows down your labor some, and if it slowed down your labor too much, whether you would then have to have a cesarean birth that you may not have had to have otherwise. So that would be a slightly additional risk. But on the other hand, if your pain is such that you're not progressing in labor, the right timed epidural can actually allow you to progress along vaginally, whereas others may have given up and had cesarean births. So I think some of the birthing books sometimes focus on the negatives and don't really give enough true credit to all the positives of a situation. But with the epidural timing, we know better about the timing of giving it. And not only that, we know a little bit more about using medications like Pitocin. However, I don't think that we would argue that more Pitocin is definitely given to women with epidurals than women who labor spontaneously. And then use of Pitocin has its own risk-benefit profile. So I think that's what the book's referring to. But epidurals are very safe. They're fairly widely used. There are many hospitals across the United States where 85-90% of their patients actually get epidurals. We don't have that here in our community near that high a statistic. But they've really helped many women and should be definitely considered as an alternative for laboring women who might be interested in them.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Essentially, what we're talking about here is medication that's given to reduce pain,
right.
for women in labor. Are there other things that one can do, either in the run up to delivery or even once a woman starts to go into labor, if the idea of having that medication makes you uncomfortable, or at least you'd like to say, well, let's hold off on that, and what can we do before coming to that point?
Well, I think maybe I better explain a little bit better what an epidural is.
Yeah.
We have our spinal cord where our nerves are, and in the lower part of the spinal cord are nerves that are the lumbar region nerves and the sacral region nerves. And it's those, the lower lumbar and the upper sacral region nerves that innervate the whole uterus and then the perineum. So when we talk about labor pain relief, we talk about relief from the contractions itself and relief for the birthing process itself. And the birthing process itself would mean the perineum, where the baby comes out, pain relief in that area. So that if you're talking about alternatives, there are alternatives that are for the labor process, the contractions, the progress, and there are alternatives for the actual birth itself. And alternatives for the labor process are primarily psychoprophylaxis, or most of us call it Lamaze, breathing, understanding what your labor is going to be like, understanding what the contraction are going to be like, understanding a little bit about what the contraction patterns are, how they present, how fast they come on, how fast they go away. And that alone seems to allow most people a lot of pain relief. And then they teach these methods to basically distract you. So you're doing your breathing and you're thinking about your breathing. And yes, you're well oxygenating. That's a good side benefit. And yes, you're relaxing your muscles, and relaxed muscles are less painful. But also, you're getting significantly distracted. You're paying attention to your patterns and so forth, and focusing elsewhere and working with your partner, and you're distracted. So that's the main type of pain relief. You can also get intravenous injections, or intramuscular injections, which are actual pain relief, and they can range from types of sedatives to types of narcotics. You can also then, for the birthing process, get numbing shots for just that area where the baby's going to come through, and that will help relieve the pain of the birthing process as well. So those are the primary alternatives that we have now.
Okay. We do have about 6-7 minutes left. If someone wants to ask a question, 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, she's here with us each month. We talk about women's health. You have something else you want to talk?
Well, yes, and it was actually at the end of August, but I don't think I got a chance to talk about it on the September show, that talked about the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issuing advisory on the use of hormonal contraception in women with pre-existing medical conditions. And they said that, in fact, published studies, again, we're talking off-label use here, published studies have documented the safety and effectiveness in healthy women, but they are specifically notifying patients and warning patients and their providers, because this directly came from the college to me as a board-certified obstetrician gynecologist, that that the data are less conclusive with women with underlying conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, migraines, fibrocystic breast tissue, fibroids, or elevated cholesterol. And they said that women with a family history of breast cancer or chronic conditions, for instance, this morning I was talking to a patient with a very strong family history of cholesterol disorders, and you know, whether or not this would be an issue for her in contraceptive. And they're talking about discussing the risks and benefits and reminding us that unintended pregnancy could pose substantial health risks for the woman and her unborn child. And it was interesting, the 1995 figures, you know how these figures lag, but 1995 figures, 10.4 million women in the United States use oral contraceptives, and 1.1 million use Depo-Provera injection, and 500,000 use implants. So we're talking to a lot of women.
Okay. We have at least one more person here to talk with on our show. Ellsworth is the caller, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a question. If you are taking Evista, and what about taking also some naturally occurring plant estrogens with such as a soy drink?
Well, it's been my general philosophy that soy has so many health benefits, particularly on your cholesterol, that it is an excellent addition to our food, our diet. It's also been my general belief that most women in the United States that are adding soy to their diet are not adding tremendous amounts of soy to their diet, and that it can be done beneficially or safely. Two caveats, however, that we do have to consider is, one, if you're adding a tremendous amount of soy to your diet, would it ever interfere with the use of estrogen medicines? And I think most physicians are inclined to say probably not, but I would have to say truthfully that we may not know. And the other thing is that One thing we've learned from, for instance, the use of tamoxifen, tamoxifen is a sort of an Evista cousin in that it's also considered a SERM, a selective estrogen receptor modulator. It doesn't have the same hormonal chemical configuration as Evista, but it can also act as estrogen in some tissues and anti-estrogen in other tissues differently than Evista, different actions in different tissues. But one thing that we've learned from tamoxifen is that paradoxically, if it's given to women before the time of menopause, actually it can cause bone thinning, whereas if it's used in women after the time of menopause, it can cause the bones, it can help prevent osteoporosis. So that we know that depending on what your hormones are, different medicines act differently. And we don't understand for every patient how to tease that out individually. So I guess the quick answer is probably beneficial. Don't overdo it and keep watching the research because more will need to be done.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we have about a minute or so left. Is there one more quick thing you want to
There was. About? I thought that it was interesting and kind of continuing on our FDA theme. If our listeners want to go to the FDA health site, which is on the web, which is at fda.gov, you can specifically do a research under breast implants. And I know, I don't know the exact number, but we have had a large number of women in the United States with breast implants, and they specifically have a lot of new information on what can happen to breast implants, particularly what they call capsular contracture, when the capsule scars off and contracts around the implant. And they actually have pictures of what it looks like when your breast capsule has developed a problem or when your implant has developed a problem. So you can look at the picture, you can do a breast exam and help understand whether or not there have been any abnormalities developed that you need to consult a physician about. And I think that that it would be a good source of information for women who have implants.
All right.
Or thinking of getting one.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank
here.
You.
Dr. Suzanne Troopen, she's here with us every month on the show, always on a Monday. We talk about women's health.